So, if you remember right, last week we had talked about worship, the importance really of worship, and how the feasts and the offerings were just filled with Israel's worship for the Lord, and how important it is for us to, one of the things that was pointed out was that, just a quick reminder here, in verse 4 of chapter 28, that there was a daily offering, right? And it consisted of an offering in the morning, and it consisted of an offering in the evening. And it certainly sets the tone for our devotion to the Lord. So when we have devotions to the Lord, sometimes, you know, me and Mariah was talking about it. I'm a morning person, so my morning devotions come relatively easy. I won't say they're always easy, but most of the time, meeting the Lord in the morning is okay with me. In the evening is another story, right? You get home from work or whatever the day may lend itself to, and you feel pretty unambitious. And so I have a tendency of, you know, let's just vegetate and breathe, and I don't think about the devotion so much then. But so me and Mariah were having a chat this past week about keeping each other kind of accountable for that, because she's just the opposite, you know. So, but just to be able to, you know, because the Lord should always be in it, right? It should always, you know, whatever we're doing, evening, morning, He should always be in it. So the importance of devotion, and through that, that phrase, morning and evening, it always reminded us, as it went into the monthly offerings, it went into the Sabbath offering, it went into the different feasts and whatever, the Lord made it clear to Moses that these were not replacements for our morning and evening offering. It was something that we, you know, we did anyways. We did it because, and this was additional. You know, we did this devotion every morning and evening because we can't wait a month, can we, to meet with the Lord? I mean, it's almost like that's just serious nonsense, right? If we think that we're going to get away with that. Karen, actually, I think you had counted, went through that evening or the next day or whatever. I can't remember. How many did you find? 17 reminders that it didn't replace, right? And it would always say besides the regular burnt offerings and the drink offerings, or, you know, the morning, the evening. So just a number of reminders there. Don't leave it out, you know. So just wanted to remind you today that that was an important lesson, I think, that we learned last week. And though we should all know that, you know, it's good to be reminded. So today, into chapter 30, it's interesting here because it speaks of the vows and the oaths that we offer up to the Lord. When we promise something, when we say, I promise I will do this, you know, that should mean something to us. So many promises are broken, right? But it's important that our words mean something, especially to the Lord. You know, when we say, Lord, I promise that I will pray about this situation more fervently, more frequently. You know, we should be doing that, right? It's not just empty words. Leviticus 27, we had looked at vows there, and it was in terms of dedicating people and possessions. But this chapter here actually talks about personal vows and how they affect our relationship, or are affected by relationships. This chapter is clear that the home is the basis of a nation. You know, what goes on in the individual homes. And we see it today, right? We see mass confusion in our nation. We see people doing things that they shouldn't be doing. They don't know right from wrong, and why is that? You know, I heard a guy talking on the radio. I can't tell you who he was. I really wasn't paying that close of attention to him, but he was. I think it was a Focus on the Family episode in a sense, and they had this guy talking about families, and he was explaining. You know, he was supposed to be the expert, and he said that he actually had a boy that had become a Christian come to him. He was a young man come to him. He wasn't married or anything, and he said, this young man came to me and he said, Mr. So-and-so, do you think I could live with you for a few months? He said, well, why is that? The kid was very responsible. He had a job and whatnot. I think he might have been going to school. I can't recollect. But he said, can I live with you and your family? He said, you see, I grew up in a dysfunctional home, and I honestly don't know what a normalcy is, right? And so he wanted to get an understanding of how this guy was running his home, you know. And our nation today is very dysfunctional, right? We think it's okay that children rule the family. We think it's okay that they govern the household. And the father, he's taken a separate seat. See, he's taken a seat in the corner, and his wife is running the show. And we see that in sitcoms. We see it made fun of, you know, and so forth. And certainly it isn't the proper order of the home. And this kind of lays out, this chapter actually lays out here the responsibility of the husband towards a vow, the responsibility of a father towards a vow, specifically of women. So it sets up, you know, everything that we find in Ephesians, and the alignment of the family and the order of the family is found somewhat in here. At least we see little snippets of it. Another thing that we see here is that truth, right? We talk about truth. Is there absolute truth? Truth is what binds a society, right? It either holds it together or it tears it apart. Lies does nothing for the foundation or the fabric of society other than be deceitful and ruin people, right? So truth binds a society together. This chapter talks about a vow and it talks about an oath. So here's the difference between the two. What is the difference? Well, a vow is a promise to do. So when you say to the Lord, Lord, I will do that, that's a vow. When you think about an oath, what's an oath? An oath is a promise not to do. Okay, so it's a vow is to do and an oath is not to do. But whatever it is, right, a vow and an oath, it's always to the Lord. It's something that we say to the Lord. And certainly as we say an oath or a vow to the Lord, we need to keep the perspective that He is God. You know, He is a holy God. He is a just God. He's got the upper hand in a sense. But verse 1 says, and Moses spoke to the heads of the tribes concerning the children of Israel, saying, this is the thing which the Lord has commanded. If a man makes a vow to the Lord, can you do me a favor, honey? Just shut that door. I just hear voices and it's probably going to be back on there. I'll start over once you're back in. It says, then Moses spoke to the heads of the tribes concerning the children of Israel, saying, this is the thing which the Lord has commanded. If a man makes a vow to the Lord or swears an oath to bind himself by some agreement, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. Isn't that just revolutionary kind of thing today? Today, as men speak, the more they speak, the more they lie. Right? We see that in our politics as we get ready for the election here back in the fall. Men will say a lot of things, will convince people by their lies, yet they don't uphold them, do they? Just to get their way, just to get into an office. Some of them, we understand, isn't just their whole in their power, but some of it's outside their reach, right? But they get in office and they don't do what they say. They don't even try to do what they say. They convince us them and then they don't uphold what they say in truth. So the expectation here that God sets forth through Moses is that when a man makes a vow or an oath, they had to keep it. Right? There was no backing out here, right? It says the oath to bind himself by some agreement, he shall not break his word. There isn't a way out. There isn't a back door for a man. And so often do we give back doors to truth. Or to a man's word, you know. Loopholes. You know, we've heard that in contracts, loopholes. Well, there was this loophole in that criminal. Yes, he purged himself, but created perjury, but he got out of it because of this loophole or whatever. But then what about women, right? So the next little while here, we'll hit on that. There's three that are considered here, but the first one starts in verse 3. It says, "For if a woman makes a vow to the Lord and binds herself by some agreement while in her father's house in her youth, and her father hears her vow, and the agreement by which she was bound has bound herself and her..." Yikes, there's some lightning, huh? "And her father holds his peace." I just noticed that thing. I thought it was the lightning hitting that screen or something. Anyways, let's start over, somewhat over here. Now my legs stop shaking here. "And her father hears her vow," verse 4, "and her father hears her vow and the agreement by which she has bound herself, and her father holds his peace, then all her vows shall stand, and every agreement with which she has bound herself shall stand. But if her father overrules her by the day that he hears, then none of her vows nor her agreements by which she has bound herself shall stand, and the Lord shall release her because her father overrule her. If indeed she takes a husband while bound by her vow and by a rash utterance from her lips by which she bound herself, and her husband hears it and makes no response to her on the day that he hears, then her vow shall stand and her agreement by which she bound herself shall stand. But if her husband overrules her on the day that he hears it, he shall make void her vow which she told and what she uttered with her lips by which she bound herself, and the Lord will release her." Well, the one thing that we learn here, well, first the father dictates whether the vow is kept or not, or agrees to it. You can kind of see the pattern here, and then of course, if the ladies married, that overrules the father's agreement there to hold the vow or whatever there. So you can see that the father is in charge of his family. He can disapprove. He can approve. If he's silent, you know, we always say silence is consensus, right? So if he was silent in both regards, whether father or husband, silence is consensus, meaning that you have agreed to it. It's on your shoulders in a sense. As soon as the engagement was brought about, there was a new authority, right? The engagement or the fellow that will marry his daughter there now trumps the father. And we talk about leaving and cleaving, right? We talk about when you get married, you're leaving your parents and you're cleaving to your husband. You see the order throughout the scriptures. And I see it in here, you know, where as soon as she leaves, because think of it this way. See, it's not like today. Today, a guy wants to marry a wife or a lady. He goes and he asks her. He says, "Will you marry me?" And then they go over to her parents' house and they tell them, right? That's kind of how it works today, unfortunately. And it did for us too, I guess. So I can't say as I was, I did it maybe the way I wish I had done it, maybe. But back here, see, that didn't happen. See, you went to the father and said, "Hey, can I marry your daughter?" And he said, "No." Right? Pay up. No, he did kinda, right? There was a payment in a sense that they offered up to the father. But it was under his authority that he is now, the father has ordained his future son-in-law to, in a sense, make decisions for their family, right? He isn't going to butt in, so it's the leave-cleave principle for sure. So we see that here. And then verse 9, the second one, the second situation where of a woman, it says, "Also, any vow of a widow or a divorced woman by which she has bound herself shall stand against her." So here's a widow or a divorced woman. I guess it seems, or at least we can assume here that they have some sort, this widow and divorced woman has some sort of experience in life. They're experienced in handling and dealing with situations, right? Because they're now alone, they're making the decisions on their own. And they have a certain sense of maturity, right? And so they are held just like the man was. They were held to that vow. And of course, there was no explanation here of if the divorced woman or if the widow happened to be married. The question still perhaps remains, what happens then, right? I would assume that it would follow the same suit as the woman that was taken by a man from her father to betroth. But I don't know. It doesn't really say much further than that. Then it says in verse 10, if she vowed in her father's house, so now speaking of the married woman, if she vowed in her husband's house or bound herself by an agreement with an oath, and her husband heard it and made no response to her and did not overrule her, then all her vows shall stand, and every agreement by which she bound herself shall stand. But if her husband truly made them void on the day he heard them, then whatever proceeds from her lips concerning the vows and concerning the agreements binding her, It shall not stand. Her husband has made them void, and the Lord will release her. Every vow and every binding oath to afflict her soul and her husband may confirm it, and her husband may make it void. Now, if her husband makes no response whatever to her from day to day, when he confirms all her vows and all the agreements that bind her, he confirms them because he made no response to her on the day that he heard them. But if he does make them void after he has heard them, then he shall bear her guilt. These are the statutes which the Lord commanded Moses between a man and his wife, and between a father and his daughter in her youth, in her father's house. So again, here we see silence means consensus. But the husband has a opportunity, even after the vow is made, that the husband can disagree with it. He can change his mind, right? But according to Leviticus 5, he has to pay the penalty, or he has to offer a sin offering up to the Lord because he broke that vow. Remember, a vow is to do. So, breaking a promise, how serious is that? Well, we would look at it today just to break a promise. But to break a promise to the Lord has big impact, right? It costs something its life. It was sin to break a promise. So it cost an offering. It cost a sacrifice. It cost an animal its life. And I think if we would only look at our promises, even to brothers and sisters, not even to the Lord, of how impactful they can be, right, to somebody. I've heard people say, "Well, I didn't expect anything more than what I received from that individual, but he said that he would do that, didn't he?" Well, yeah, but he always says he'll do that. You know, so you get those kind of responses from people. It's almost a expectation people have of certain individuals. Hey, they just don't keep their word. Hey, I'll meet you tonight. I bet they'll meet me tonight. I've had so many guys call me up and say, "Oh, I want to get together. What time do you want to get together?" You know, and they'll say, "Oh, how about," and I can tell as they're making the date, man, they're just about ready to cancel it off their calendar. Right? Or the best line I always like, "Pastor, I'm going to be in church on Sunday." Right. Right. You know? I remember when Bob passed, you know, one of the guys that used to go here. I talked to him for a while and I said, "You know, you need to get back in fellowship." And he said, "I'm going to be coming back to church. I haven't seen him yet." You know? I mean, we look at our world today, right? We look at our world. We look at broken contracts. Some people think a legal document isn't worth the paper it's written on. They think that now they can come plead with you and you'll be okay with them breaking. Wait a minute. Do you understand that you're putting people in a position that an uncomfortable position for one, but you put them, sometimes it's a financial position. Wait a minute, you said you were going to pay this, and now you're saying you're not going to pay it. Now you say you don't want the deal that we gave you. Well, now you know, and so forth, and I can give you a good example, but I won't. Marriage vows. Right? Marriage vows are to the Lord. Right? But today we can get a $50 divorce you know, kind of thing. I mean, I don't know how expensive they are. I'm just saying that it's a lot easier than what it should be, right? You just got to be in agreement. The couple has to be in agreement to get the divorce so that there's no fuss, right? No fault divorces, you know, kind of thing. And what does that do? What does marriage vow breaking do? It messes the family up, right? Oh, they're too young to understand. They're only 3-4 years old. Oh no, they'll understand eventually. Why do you think you wet his bed? Why do you think they cry at night when mama isn't there? Right? And I mean, I couldn't imagine it, tell you the truth, because when we put it this way, when we go somewhere, right? One of us goes somewhere, and the boys get put to bed at 7 o'clock or so. They always ask us, when daddy comes home, can you have him come in and kiss me goodnight? When mommy comes home, can you have her come in and kiss me goodnight? Don't tell me that doesn't have an impact on kids, because it does, you know. You know, and of course today, highlighting the news is all the political rhetoric that we hear, you know, and, you know, I'm gonna work for you. I'm gonna do this and I'm gonna do that, you know. Craziness what people want to, you know, believe. And, you know, I was thinking even today, you know, as I was listening to Trump there a little bit in his victory speech and all that stuff. That guy's got more air than I think one human being should even consume, you know. but you know, I'm listening to him. I think he thinks he's God. I'm going to change this. I'm going to put border control up. I'm going to do this. I'm going to make the government of Mexico pay for that wall that we're going to put up. Are you? Okay. And you know, just a bunch of political rhetoric, you know, that amounts to basically, does it amount to truth? Some of it might. A lot of it doesn't. We've been through this enough times to know that a man is not going to save the world. The only one is Jesus, right? He's the only one that can. He's the only one that a leader has ever spoken complete and absolute truth. And as soon as he did that, see, they put him up on that cross and they crucified him. But thankfully, it was God that they were crucifying, so he rose from the dead, right? Had victory for us. But even perjury in a witness stand, you know, sitting in the court, perjury, you know, I mean, look at O.J. Simpson, right? Here's a guy that we all watched on. We know that guy is guilty as charged, right? There's not many people that stand in this country that didn't watch that whole thing unfold and perjury, you know, but never to be convicted of that, of course. So do we want God to keep his promises? You know, when somebody promises us something, we want them to keep the promise, right? So when we promise somebody something, shouldn't it go that way too? You know, so if we expect God to keep his promises, then I'm sure God expects us to keep our promises to him as well. The other message here is, of course, authority within our families, within our homes, within our society, you know, and so forth. Proverbs 20:25 says this. It says, "It is a snare for a man to devote rashly something as holy and afterwards to reconsider his vow, saying, a vow is holy to God. And then reconsider it. Reconsider what words he said. Ecclesiastes 5, verses 4 through 5, says, when you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have vowed. Better not to vow than to vow and not pay. And that goes, that doesn't necessarily mean just money. It means keeping the agreement. You know, keeping the agreement. And we go on to 31 here, and it switches gears a little bit. It talks about the vengeance of the Lord on the Midianites. The Midianites, Balak, right, tried to have Balaam back in chapter 22 and 24, have Balaam curse Israel, right, through demonic means, right? He wanted him to use his sorcery and whatnot. And some, you know, if we go back to, let's see, yeah, if you go back to verse 3 of chapter 25, it says, so Israel was joined to Baal of Peor, and the Lord, and the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel. So they joined forces. In chapter 25 there, Balaam had persuaded them to join Baal of Peor, the false gods, and worship the false gods. And of course, they did that. But that's what God had against the Midianites and Midian was that. And also, you know, the scripture says in Genesis 12 that the Lord said to Abraham, get out of the country. Remember, he told him to get out of the country. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you, make you great. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you. And so when Midian and Balak wanted to curse the Israelites, well, God took offense to that, of course, and then in Numbers 25 there would punish those in charge. And he would use a man named Phinehas to really stand up to the right thing. And so in chapter 31 here, we read about the vengeance on the Midianites. And it says, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, take vengeance on the Midianites for the children of Israel. Afterwards you shall be gathered to your people. So Moses spoke to the people, saying, arm some of yourselves for war, and let them go against the Midianites to take vengeance for the Lord on Midian. 1,000 from each tribe of all the tribes of Israel you shall send to the war. So 12,000 they would suit up. So there were recruited from the divisions of Israel, 1,000 from each 12,000 armed for war. Then Moses sent them to the war. 1,000 from each tribe he sent them to the war with Phinehas, the son of Eleazar. Remember how he stood up and really, you know, as they were committing harlotry in Moab there, he stood up and took offense to it, as we all should when it goes against our Lord. with the holy articles and the signal trumpets in his hands, he warred against the Midianites, against just as the Lord commanded Moses. And they killed all the males. They killed the king of Midian with the rest of those who were killed. Evi, Rechem, Zur, Hur, and Reba, the five kings of Midian, Balaam, the son of Beor, who also killed with the sword, the children was also killed with the sword. The children of Israel took the women of Midian captive with their little ones and took as spoiled all their cattle, all their flocks, and all their goods. They also burned with fire all the cities where they dwelt and all their forts, and they took all the spoil and all the booty, all of men and beast. And of course, this would be Moses' last hurrah, as he led the children of Israel, and we've talked about it before, as he knew he wasn't going into the promised land, but he was a faithful leader to lead them into battle even then. God would declare this against the Midianites due to their deception, because they had led Israel into sin, into harlotry. In a sense, you could say that Israel cheated on the Lord, and the Midianites caused it. They deceived them into that cheating. This here was a holy war. If you remember right, God had prepared His people for this. He had counted them. Remember? He set up the census and he counted those people, and they had to be 20 years old or older to fight in the war. And I think, though this here is a holy war, and certainly, you know, God doesn't call us into holy wars like this anymore, but He does call us into a spiritual warfare. And He says, by golly, you need to be prepared. And if you think about it, God in the physical would take 20 years and older, but, you know, I think in the spiritual, He wants mature Christians in battle. Because that's the way we can be used in battle. It's hard to be used when you're immature in Christ. When you don't have any understanding of who He is. How do you fend off the enemy? You know? Through prayer? Through God's Word, right? Didn't Jesus, even as the devil was leading them to pinnacles and trying to convince them that He could give them all this stuff, didn't the Lord just use the Word of God? And so it makes it very important that we're sunk in here, that we're rooted, that we're, you know, that we're anchored, right? We sing that song, JP sings it often enough for us to remember, right? I'm anchored in Your Word, it says, right? I'm anchored in Your love. Well, if you're anchored in His love, you better be anchored in His Word, or you don't know what His love is, right? So it's... So from a spiritual standpoint, we need to be spiritually mature. The other thing that the battle required was bravery. It required men that weren't afraid to die, right? To go forth, to use the weapons that the Lord gave them. They needed devoted soldiers. They couldn't be wandering off during the warfare. You know, useless soldier, wandering aimlessly, right? After this, after that, you know, rabbit trails all over the place. And I think of that in the Christian life. God can't use the soldiers that gets detoured. Hey, you know, we got to be focused. We got to be focused on the enemy, right? We got to be focused. We understand the enemy, right? We know his schemes and everything. We got to be focused in our warfare. If we were to go back to chapter 25, verse 7 talks about Phinehas. It says, "And when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he arose up." He saw the harlotry, right? It says that he arose from among the congregation and took his javelin in his hand, and he went after the man of Israel into the tent and thrusted both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman through her body. So the plague was stopped among the children of Israel. I like that. It says he rose from among the congregation. Here's the congregation. You know, I think of our church, and I think folks have to rise up, you know. Really need to get serious about the Lord. You know, and in our midst, who's going to do that? Who's going to rise up? You know, who's going to take what the Lord says over what the world says? Who's going to take the opinion of the Lord, or the fact of the Lord, the truth of the Lord, over the opinion of their neighbor? You know. And those who died in the plague were 25,000. It's a serious epidemic even today. Sin causes death. There's no doubt that death occurs because of the sin of man. And so we have to be careful that, you know, that the effects of sin. And I look at Phinehas here and I think, gee, you know, here's a guy that rose above all the congregation. He took a stance for the Lord in holiness. Back to 31 there. It says they killed off all the males. Right? All the Midianites, male men. The postal service was all dead. No, just a joke. But the interesting thing is that none, and you'll find this later in the chapter, none of the Jewish soldiers would die during this battle. All the kings and Balaam, who seduced Israel in chapter 25 there, were dead. They took and they burned all the cities. All the cities of the Midianites. Why did they do this? Because God didn't want any temptation left. He didn't want anything that was left behind by the Midianites to tempt them into idolatry, harlotry. And so they burnt all the cities. And then it says in verse 12 of 31, it says, "Then they brought the captives, the booty, the spoil to Moses, to Eleazar the priest, and to the congregation of the children of Israel, to the camp in the plains of Moab by the Jordan across from Jericho." And Moses, Eleazar the priest, and all the leaders of the congregation went to meet them outside the camp. But Moses was angry with the officers of the army, with the captains over thousands and captains over hundreds who had come from battle. And Moses said to them, "Have you kept all the women alive?" Look, these women caused the children of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to trespass against the Lord in the incident of Peor. Just a reminder, he was reminding them of the damage that had happened back in Peor. And there was a plague among the congregation of the Lord. Now therefore kill every male among the little ones, and kill every woman who has known a man intimately. But keep alive for yourselves all the young women who have not known a man intimately. And as for you, remain outside the camp 7 days. Whoever has killed any person and whoever has touched any slain, purify yourself and your captives on the 3rd day and on the 7th day. Purify every garment, everything made of leather, everything woven of goat's hair, and everything made of wood. Then Eleazar the priest said to the men of war who had gone to battle, "This is the ordinance of the law which the Lord commanded Moses. Only the gold, the silver, the bronze, the iron, the tin, and the lead. Everything that has can endure fire, you shall put through the fire, and it shall be clean, and it shall be purified with the water of purification. But all that cannot endure fire, you shall put through water, and you shall wash your clothes on the 7th day and be clean, and afterwards may come into the camp." So, initially here, obviously, Moses very angry that they hadn't taken care of business, that they only took care of the men and forgot about the women there. And why was he angry? Well, first of all, I think they were brought into the camp. Those that had birthed, in a sense, those that had birthed evil. You know, and sometimes we have these alliances, you know. We take on evil alliances in the world. You know, we make business deals with evil alliances, and the Lord isn't pleased with that, you know, as we bring evil into the camp. And even in our homes, as we have TVs, right, and some of the stuff that filters through that, we got to be careful. Be careful not to bring evil into the homes. Moses would instruct them how to take care of business, right? That they would kill all the male children and those that had given birth. Remember, God didn't want any temptation within the camp. He wanted a holy people in the camp. See, what happens is that sometimes when we have victory over the enemy, we get a little lackadaisical, you could say. Yes, it was a great battle. We won the battle, but we got to be careful that we don't lose the victory, right? That somehow we don't really, in the long run, get defeated because we've allowed some of this sin to come into our lives. And we've allowed it to come into the camps that we habitate. And of course, those that had killed people out in the war, or had contact with the dead during the battle, would have to go through the purification process outlined in Numbers chapter 19. And the purification process was a reminder that God was holy, and to be in His camp, they were required to be pure, right? So for us, application here is that God's requirement hasn't changed. He still expects that His people be holy. And when we have touched death, meaning sin leads to death, right? The wages of sin is death. When we have touched sin, we need to get right with the Lord. It's a time for us to call on the Lord for His purification, right? So that we can have communion with Him. So we can have that intimacy with the Lord that He desires. Also, this battle was preparation ground. You know, you don't like to think of a battle as that. But remember, Moses wasn't going to the promised land. He was going to die shortly here. This was a preparation ground for Israel to learn. You know, I don't know if you've ever done this before, but after getting done with many of projects in corporate before, I always, after we got done, we would sit down and we would say, what went right and what went wrong? What took too long and why did the resources run out here and not here and so forth? And you go through the pluses and minuses and you try to learn something from that, right? This here was in a sense a mock battle for Israel. As they got ready to enter the land, they were going to meet up with the Canaanites, right? Vicious people. And they were going to have to fight against them, and not only fight physically, but fight spiritually. Because the same thing was going to occur there, was that they had choices whether to kill them off or to maybe hold on to a few. And we'll see how that works out. And maybe we'll refer back to this when we get there. Because I think next book that we're going to go into is Joshua. We're going to skip over Deuteronomy and go right into Joshua. And we'll see there some of the things with the Canaanites for sure. Verses 25 here, it says, now the Lord spoke to Moses saying, count up the plunder that was taken of the man and beast, you and Eleazar the priest and the chief fathers of the congregation, and divide the plunder into two parts between them who took part in the war and who went out to battle and all the congregation, Levi a tribute to the Lord, for the Lord on the men of war who went out to battle, one of every 500 of the persons, the cattle, the donkey, and the sheep. Take it from their halves and give it to Eleazar the priest as a heave offering to the Lord. And from the children of Israel, half you shall take, one of every 50. Draw from that the persons, the cattle, the donkey, and the sheep, from all the livestock, and give them to the Levites who keep charge of the tabernacle of the Lord. So Moses and Eleazar the priest did as the Lord commanded Moses. The booty remained from the plunder, which the men of war had taken, was 675,000 sheep. 72, that's quite the herd, huh? 72,000 cattle, 61,000 donkeys, and 32,000 persons in all of women who had not been known a man intimately. In half the portion of those who had gone out to war was in number 337,500 sheep. And the Lord's tribute of the sheep was 675. The cattle was 36,000, and of which the Lord's tribute was 72. The donkeys were 30,500, of which the Lord's tribute was 61. The persons were 16,000, of which the Lord's tribute was 32 persons. So Moses gave the tribute, which was the Lord's heave offering, to Eleazar the priest, as the Lord commanded Moses. And the children of Israel's half, which Moses separated from the men who fought. Now the half belonged to the congregation was 337,500 sheep, 36,000 cattle, 30,500 donkeys, and 16,000 persons. And from the children of Israel, half Moses took one of every 50, drawn from man and beast, and gave them to the Levites, who kept charge of the tabernacle of the Lord, as the Lord commanded. So, a lot of spoil, I'll say, certainly. And it was distributed three ways, right? It was distributed, half of it was distributed to the soldiers, half to the people of the camp, and then they gave a percentage to the Lord. So the Lord got a portion as well. I think that's the one thing when we receive from the Lord that blessing, that we must not forget that really the Lord gives us victory over those things. And then the animals and the people were given to Eleazar as they had, Moses had been commanded to use in the tabernacle ministry. Then 48 through 54 there says the officers who were over thousands of the army, the captains of thousands and captains of hundred came near to Moses, and they said to Moses, "Your servants have taken a count of the men of war who are under our command, and not a man of us is missing." They must have went, "Wow, this is amazing. Therefore, we have brought an offering for the Lord. What every man found of ornaments of gold, armlets and bracelets, signet rings and earrings and necklaces, to make atonement for ourselves before the Lord." So Moses and Eleazar the priest received the gold from them, all the fashioned ornaments, and all the gold of the offering that they offered to the Lord, from the captains of a thousand and captains of hundreds, was 16,750 shekels. The men of war had taken spoil, every man for himself. And Moses and Eleazar the priest received the gold from the captains of thousands and of hundreds, and brought it into the tabernacle of meeting as a memorial for the children of Israel before the Lord. So, not one man was lost. They were so, I think, blown away by it that they decided that they would give this free will offering or this offering of thanksgiving to the Lord. And this is how it should be, right? That men and women should see the hand of God working. And we see it, and we're like in awe of it, and we just want to give Him thanks, right? And, you know, when we stall our service in the middle there to give thanksgiving to the Lord, it's a time for us to offer up, "Wow, Lord, what You have done this week," right? And verse 50 talks about atonement there. It says in there, "Therefore, we have brought an offering for the Lord, what every man found of ornaments of gold, armlets and bracelets and signet rings and earrings and so forth, to make atonement for ourselves before the Lord. That word atonement doesn't, you know, atonement for ourselves. This was not to say that this offering somehow saved their souls. Right? It was a monetary thing. Matter of fact, Psalm 49, verses 6 through 9 says, those who trust in their wealth and boast in the multitude of their riches, none of them can by any means redeem his brother, nor give to God a ransom for him. For the redemption of their souls is costly. It's much more costly than that. Man cannot pay the price monetarily. And it shall cease forever, that he should continue to live eternally and not see the pit. Peter would say in the first chapter of 1 Peter 1:18-19, knowing that you were not redeemed with corruptible things like silver or gold from your aimless conduct received by tradition from your fathers, but with the precious blood of Christ, as of a lamb without blemish and without spot. In Exodus 30, for your reference, verses 11 through 16, each time a census was taken, those that were 20 and older were given a half a shekel. And that half a shekel was known as the atonement money. This was originally used for like purchase of the material for the sockets, for the posts in the tabernacle. So it was used for ministry, right? Realizing that God spared their lives, these 12,000 soldiers wanted to give God freely. And for us, when we see what the Lord has done for us, how he has shed his blood on that cross for us and given us life eternally, you know, out of no obligation, but we just want to give him thanks, right? And I think that's the most, one of the most precious things that we can do, right, is that, hey, when we see the hand of God working, and we can recognize it, that was the Lord. Let's give him thanks. You know, he doesn't need our money, right? He just wants our praises, right, and thanksgiving.